6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt trying.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am STD Noor. And we have David K. Johnston with us. And hello, David. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Well, Esty, I'm glad to be here.
So let's jump right into business. I imagine you have been following what's going on here in Wisconsin with our illustrious Governor Scott Walker. Can you put what he's doing in the context of what you wrote about in Divided, the Perils of Our Growing Inequality?
Well, yeah, although most of that book I didn't write. I wrote three chapters.
That's true.
Most of
yes.
it is contributions by people like Elizabeth Warren, Paul Krugman, President Obama, and others. I think that Governor Walker's positions are quite clear on the issues. He believes that corporations should have more power and you should have less. He believes that you should not be as well compensated for your labor today as you have been in the past. He has an intense dislike of unions and collective bargaining, which is kind of interesting historically, because in 1792, Congress required collective bargaining as a condition of the very first subsidy law that our Congress passed. And they did this because Thomas Jefferson, a man of science, not of gut reactions, not of ideology, but of science, ordered a study of how best to help the American cod fishing fleet. Back in 1792, America was much, much more deeply in debt than it is today relative to the economy. And cod brought in one quarter of the foreign earnings that we needed to pay off the debts from both the Revolutionary War and the Articles of Confederation era when government had no power to tax. And the study showed that if you gave the subsidy to ships which just paid wages to their sailors, it wouldn't be very effective. But if you gave the subsidy where there was an advance written agreement and the workers got a share of the profits, that was their principal form of payment, they shared in the profits from the fish they caught, that it would be very effective. So you had to have a written agreement in advance. That's what collective bargaining is. And 62.5% of the subsidy went to the fishermen and sailors, and the balance went to the ship owners. So there's a clear record here of support for collective bargaining by the founders of the country. And you can read about this in a piece I wrote for Newsweek. It's online, called Why Thomas Jefferson Favored Profit Sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And it refers to a book, which this comes from, and is part of a larger historical record that I and my research assistants at the Syracuse University College of Law have been building.
Mm-hmm. So let me refer to another thing that you do mention in the book, and I didn't know that, but it turns out that full employment is a duty that Congress places by law on the Federal Reserve. Explain how this came to be and why isn't that the case? I mean, unemployment isn't terrible now, but I think Scott Walker and other governors like him are working hard on raising unemployment. So tell us about that.
Well, just to be fair to Governor Walker, I don't think he wants to raise unemployment. I just think his policies won't work. He would argue that he's trying to eliminate unemployment through his policies, and I think there's a long historical record that tells us what he's doing will not be successful.
You're nicer than me, David.
The Federal Reserve is how Congress exercises its duty to control money. The Constitution gives the federal government monopoly control over our money, and instead of doing it through the Treasury Department, we've outsourced this to the Federal Reserve for 102 years. The Federal Reserve, by law, has two principal duties. One is a stable currency, that is, deal with inflation, or, as we face some risk of, a not inflation, but a deflation, So it's supposed to avoid either inflation or deflation. And it has an equal duty to develop policies that will produce full employment. The only president of the Fed who has talked about this second duty in any depth is the current president, Janet Yellen. And if you go back and you can look on YouTube, when she was introduced by the president and he nominated her for this job, every time she spoke, she said jobs and then stable currency, jobs, low inflation, jobs, avoiding a deflation. Every other Fed chairman has talked solely or almost solely about inflation or deflation, not this duty to provide full employment.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned
provide policies that result in full employment.
You mentioned that following World War II and until the 1970s, the American middle class strengthened, grew, and had good salaries. Much of it was unionized. And then something happened to change things, and it seems that that thing that happened is really on a it's really expediting nowadays. Tell us about the time after World War II and explain what happened in the 70s, please.
Sure. Well, in the 1950s and 60s, we had lots of well-paid manufacturing jobs, and they paid well because the workers were unionized, and they were able to, as a team, and that's how Adam Smith, the man who first explained market economics in his book, The Wealth of Nations, in 1776, said people should be paid, but not individually, but in teams. And so workers were well-paid, and middle-class Americans' incomes went up tremendously during the period from 1945 till about 1970. And then we began to flatten out and fall, particularly after Reagan and much more quickly since the George Bush tax cuts in 2000. And the factors that caused this were, first of all, federal rules that weakened unions. In 1973, about 37% of private workers in America belonged to unions, and that means about 80% of workers benefited because lots of employers paid high wages and gave good benefits to keep unions out. And in very large companies, the union sort of set the floor for what people were paid who were not in the union. Then we started to open up the economy. And beginning with things like Nixon going to China, we have lost 2.8 million jobs to China. I'm not sure I can look up just how many jobs there are in Wisconsin, but I think that's roughly all of the jobs in Wisconsin. It's all the jobs in greater Philadelphia. We have signed other agreements like NAFTA and the recent South Korean trade agreement, which have cost us tremendous numbers of jobs. As employers operating on a global scale have gotten rid of Americans and replaced them with workers from overseas. And what we've seen happen is that the share of the growth in the economy that goes to workers has been shrinking steadily, but especially since 2000, and the share going to corporate profits or business profits, has been rising. In fact, since 2009, it's been taking off like a rocket. And that's at the core of what our problem is. The bottom 90% of Americans, about 320 million of us, so we're talking about, in round numbers, 280 million of us.
So
our incomes are back to where they were in 1966. In 1966, Mustangs were still new cars. Lyndon Johnson was in the White House. The war in Vietnam was going full-fledged. That's a long time ago, almost 50 years ago. We're back to the level of 1966?
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to me that the party and the party apparatchiks who use the most patriotic rhetoric are also the ones that support the kind of interest that take jobs away from Americans. Do you have an explanation for that?
Well, you're talking about the politicians here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a real problem here for if you were a politician. Esty, just imagine for a moment that instead of having this radio show, you were running for Congress and were a serious candidate to run for Congress.
Ooh.
It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. The only way you're going to get the money to run for Congress is you're going to go to people who have lots of money and whose fortunes and whose businesses depend heavily on government policy. And they're going to say to you, well, listen, you know, I'm going to give money to the other guy unless you work to get me this, 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 and this from the government. And the reality is, if you say, well, I want policies that will promote the general welfare, that's what the preamble to the Constitution says is the duty of Congress, to promote the general welfare. And by the way, in the original, the W is capitalized. The people who are important donors and whose personal and family and business incomes are often heavily influenced by government policy, they're going to say, go away. What kind of awful person are you? And they're going to back whoever it is that will either support what they want, or if they live in a district where they can't get that, who will be such a weakling that it doesn't matter.
So that really takes us right quick to the area of solutions. And, of course, there's a lot more I want to talk to you about. But that suggests that the main problem or one of the main problems is the way the political system works here. And there probably are solutions to that. What could make things better?
Well, there are some number of things we can do. They're not easy, and I don't mean to suggest they're easy. On a structural level, I believe that we need to go to public financing of campaigns. We need to get rid of private donations, or else we need to heavily cap them. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has held just the opposite. It has held that dollars are speech, which would have all the founding fathers spinning in their graves because they wrote specifically about all their fears and worries. I mean, we have a Supreme Court that has held in a recent case that a man who gave $3 million not to a candidate to be chief judge of his state, but to a committee supporting that candidate, was not buying the influence of the court. I mean, that's just such an absurd result. It's very troubling. Secondly, we need to stop the gerrymandering of congressional districts. In the 2010 and 2012 elections, the Democrats got many more votes, 5 million in one of them, than the Republicans in the House races. But the House was controlled by Republicans. And that's because districts were created that essentially corralled people likely to vote as Democrats. Union members, people who are not white, working class people who are of any race, into districts where they would be maybe 90% Democrats and almost no Republicans, to limit their influence statewide. We need to stop that kind of gerrymandering, and some states don't allow it, but some, like Texas, for example, notoriously do. On another level, the most important thing we need to do, and this doesn't require any reforms at all, is get out the vote. The reason Scott Walker survived the recall election in Wisconsin is that instead of putting all the money into getting out the vote, which is very cheap to do, the people who wanted him removed from office got into a game where they tried to outspend his supporters, including the Koch brothers, on buying ads on TV and radio. And by the way, those ads are sold at the highest price. The highest rate charged for TV advertising and radio advertising is for political ads. That's a game that you can't win against billionaires and multibillionaires. So getting people registered to vote and then getting them to the polls on election day, that's where effort should go if people want to get a government that is responsive not just to the billionaires, but to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Our guest again is David K. Johnston, an award-winning Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, also the teaches at Syracuse University College of Law and the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. His latest book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, which is the basis for what we're talking about today. As he mentioned, he wrote a very good intro and two chapters, and then other chapters have been written by leading intellectuals, researchers, politicians.
I've got President Obama.
Yes, President
Senator
Obama.
Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth
the
Warren.
Head of the Steelworkers Union. The two Nobel Prize winning economists, Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz, and they all essentially donated their work for this book. They got a little tiny payment of no consequence as a thank you. Wow. They basically donated this work.
So they donated their work to this important book so that
And the politicians turned down the money, so they didn't get anything.
You say in the intro, David, we have embraced bankruptcy, debt, long bouts of joblessness, and flat or shrinking paychecks as the new normals, and we have lavished cash and tax cuts and subtle subsidies on the richest among us. Tell us about that.
Well, on average, every American citizen is now giving $225 a year, that's $900 a year for a family of four, in subsidies, just state government and local government subsidies to corporations ranging from Walmart and Home Depot and Cabela's to Nissan and Deutsche Bank and others. Rupert Murdoch's empire gets a huge subsidy this way. And $900 a week is less than the average take-home pay of a family of four. So basically, on average, American couples with two children are giving a week's pay in tribute to big companies. And, of course, my firm belief is I want companies to do well. I want them to be prosperous, but earn your way in the marketplace. Don't make your profits by draining the pockets of people who don't have a lot of money. And incomes in this country have become so damaged that it's almost hard to believe the numbers. And so what I'm going to tell right now, I'm sure some people will find jarring, but it's in the official data, and I've written about it extensively showing it. The average income of the bottom 90% of us, that's about 280 million Americans, is back to the level of 1966.
Mm-hmm.
Lyndon Johnson was president back then. Mustangs were still quite new cars. The Beatles had hardly broken up. I was in high school mm-hmm. in 1966. Incomes for the bottom 90% have gone nowhere. And since 2000, everybody's income is down. Even people in the 1% of the 1%, that's a group that Mitt Romney is near the bottom of, despite how wealthy he is.
Oh, really?
Their incomes are down. Everybody's income is down. In fact, when George Bush ran for president in 2000, you know, he said, elect me and my tax cut policies and everybody will be better off. And he said this starting in 1998, and he said it hundreds of times. So in October of 2000, when I was the tax reporter for the New York Times, I called the Bush campaign. And I said, well, you know, you guys have started saying that we're going into if we aren't already in, the Al Gore recession. And if we go into a recession, that means people are worse off. So you sure you don't want to hedge your bets, you know, and say, well, it may take a year or two for the tax cuts. Who is your boss? I was asked.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him the number of the executive editor of the New York Times. But I finally got an answer to the question. And the answer was, there are no ifs, ands, or buts about it. If George Bush is elected president and his tax cuts are put in place, every American will be better off. Okay. And then he said, so when's your story running? And I said, well, in about 10 years. Because that's when the data would become available. Well, we now have data for the whole 12 years. Because remember, President Obama agreed to extend the Bush tax cuts for 2 years.
Yes.
Here's how bad it is. Incomes are $6.6 trillion less than if we had stayed at the level of 2000. Now, that's a meaningless number, $6.6 trillion. It's $48,000 per household. It is enough money to pay all the income taxes on that money, all the payroll taxes, Social Security and Medicare taxes, to pay off every car loan in America, every credit card debt in America, every student loan in America, and every taxpayer would have $18,000 cash left over.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a disaster for our country. Now, I know there are people listening who are saying, well, wait a minute, what about 9/11 and the war in Iraq? You know, I asked the campaign about that very clearly, and I said, I even suggested to them, well, what if we had a worldwide pandemic like the 1918 flu that killed millions of people? No, there were no qualifiers. And to his credit, President Bush never waffled on his claim that right up to the day he left office, that his tax cuts would make us better off. In fact, the very last page the Bush administration posted at its White House website specifically invites the kind of critique I just gave. So the facts are in, and the facts show that this has been a disaster. Everybody is worse off. And since the recession ended in 2009, of all the gains of income that have resulted since then, we're still way below where we were in 2000, but we're higher than we were in 2009. The 1% of the 1%, that's just 16,000 households. I mean, think about this entire country, 160 million households, just 16,000 of them. What's that, the population, the number of households in Madison? Probably got a third of all the increased income. Less than that, okay.
Oh yeah,
a third of all the increased income. The 1% that's the best off 3.2 million Americans got 95 cents out of every dollar of increased income, and the bottom 90% incomes are down. Incomes are down.
So the
reason people don't see this so much is it's been a very long, slow, you know, being the frog in the pan where the heat's coming up, it just hasn't gotten so hot that the frog leaps out of it, which is, by the way, what the frog ultimately does, contrary to the myth about it.
Let me get to our caller, though, and then we'll get back to Wisconsin, David. David, caller, you are on the air.
Thank you. Yes, I would like to ask the guest, if he sees a tipping point. I've been working the same job for 25 years, and it's building awnings, which a lot of it is commercial signage, basically, and so it's sensitive to, it's seasonal somewhat, but it's sensitive to, you know, small business confidence, and I haven't had a raise in 8 years, and I'm wondering, you know, and I'm going deeper in debt all the time, and I'm wondering if he sees a tipping point. Is this thing just going to keep getting worse and worse, or is there an end in sight? If the economy improves, really improves, I'll be the first to know. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And David K. Johnson.
Yeah, this is an incredibly widespread problem in America. And there are lots of people who are being paid much less than they were a few years ago. So when you add inflation into it, it's really awful. Yes, in the long run, if we don't fix this, there will come a point where young people will revolt against this. And I don't want to have that happen. That would be the worst possible outcome here. I think people need to recognize that you've got to get Congress to pay attention to ordinary people. And the way you do that is, first of all, people have to vote, and they have to know who they're voting for. Secondly, when your congressperson shows up or people who are from, you know, within some reasonable distance of you or your senator, get a group of people together, develop a strategy about questions you want to ask, scatter yourselves through the audience, ask polite, very brief focus, that is, write it down ahead of time, know what you want to say, questions. And when the politician tries, as they typically do, to sort of skate off a tough question, other people around the room will say, wait a minute, you didn't answer the question. Answer the question. And if this happens to them enough, they will begin to get the message that they've got to pay attention to the great majority of Americans. President John Adams said that it's the duty of our government to produce the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. And that, and he also said, as have other presidents, that it is no measure of our success as a democracy to make the rich better off. Now, that's not saying anybody is opposed to rich people or people getting rich. It's that government's role here is to help everybody get better off by setting up rules that everybody benefits from. And let me just tell you one other thing that Adams and Madison both warned us about, both presidents. They warned about the America would see in time a business aristocracy, where the Constitution prohibits any royalty, but that doesn't mean you can't have business aristocrats. And that if people did not own their own land, if they were farmers, and did not own their own tools, if they were workers, or didn't otherwise have some capital, that the business aristocrats would persuade people wholly dependent on wages to vote for policies that they would, that the business aristocrats would say were better off for wage earners, but in fact were terrible for the wage earners and would make the business aristocrats even richer and more powerful. And I think that's what we're seeing going on today. Large numbers of people who have no wealth, the bottom 120 million Americans own one-third of 1% of the wealth in this country. 120 million people, one-third of 1% of the wealth. And they have been persuaded, many of them, by the business aristocrats and their friends to vote for policies and vote for politicians who are advancing the interests of the rich and damaging the interests of everybody else because they do not understand, in many cases, how these policies work.
Actually, one interesting thing that you mentioned, David, and just shocking, really, is that since 1980, a third of households filed for bankruptcy.
I think the number in my book is one in seven, but it's a very large number by any event, and we did not have this level of bankruptcy prior to the policy changes we started making in this country with the age of Reagan. That's the important measure here, is that we've seen this huge surge of bankruptcies. It continues at a relatively high level. And we also now know, because of the work Elizabeth Warren did when she was a professor, this is more than 20 years ago now, that we used to think bankruptcy was by two groups of people. People in certain businesses like home builders who, when the economy went bust, they would go bust. And workers who didn't, you know, get stable employment. We now know that's not true, that doctors and dentists and lawyers and college professors and everybody else goes bankrupt at pretty much the same rate, and that the real factors that contribute to bankruptcy, there are three of them, and any two of them makes you highly likely to be in bankruptcy. The loss of a job, even if you have a two-income household, real serious illness that runs up big medical bills, something that isn't a problem in any other modern country, or divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Those, if two of those three factors come together, there's a very high propensity for divorce. And Elizabeth Warren got access to all these records. She figured out a way to analyze them all, a massive amount of documents. Everybody in the bankruptcy world respects the serious, careful work that she did to make us understand that. But, you know, Congress's response is to change the bankruptcy law as requested by the too-big-to-fail banks, not as public policy, the best public policy would suggest.
Mm-hmm. How do these policies affect education? What about that issue of healthcare and the way people can lose everything that they have because of the lack of healthcare in this country? And how do these things affect society as a whole? What kind of society are we going to have? In 2050 years.
Let's do healthcare first, and if I forget education, bring me back to it.
Okay.
Here's how inefficient and awful our healthcare system is. In the year 2010, if we had had the healthcare system of Germany or France, and they're very different systems, but they're both universal coverage. In France, there's no out-of-pocket costs unless you want cosmetic surgery. There's no out-of-pocket costs. The doctor sees you right away. France is widely regarded as having the best healthcare system in the world. Germany's is extremely good, but it's a different model. If we'd had the healthcare systems of either of those two countries, it would have saved us so much money that we could have gotten rid of the income tax that year, and this year we could have gotten rid of about two-thirds of the income tax.
Mm.
Now think about that. You could think about all the money comes out of your paycheck for income taxes. Wouldn't have to pay it. And I'm including everybody, poor people, rich people, the whole shebang. We could this year eliminate income taxes for everybody who makes under $100,000 a year if we had those countries' health care systems instead of the system we have.
Amazing, amazing.
Yeah,
and what we're doing with our healthcare system is making a few people very rich and putting lots of people into bankruptcy and many people into early graves. My wife and I have three friends, women who died because they had breast cancer, they didn't have insurance, and, well, you'll hear, you know, various members of Congress say, anybody can get healthcare, you just go to the hospital. Hospitals do not treat chronic diseases. They treat emergencies.
Right.
They don't treat diabetes. They don't treat cancer. But if you get cut or wounded, they'll take care of you by law, even if you can't pay the bill. And no other country does this. So the modern countries, you go and you get the care that you need. And it's inefficient and it's wasteful. So if we fixed our health care situation. And Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is a big step in the right direction, but it still maintains the insurance companies, a superfluous, unnecessary industry. Now, on education,
yes.
I'm a poster boy for what's gone wrong with education in this country. My dad was a 100% disabled veteran of World War II. Mm-hmm. I went to work in California when I was 10 years old, and I have worked full-time since I was 13 to help my parents be able to keep a roof over our heads when I was a boy.
Mm-hmm.
College was free in the 60s in California. So I got a college education because it was free, and I also got a little bit of money from the GI Bill because technically, and I emphasize the word technically, I'm a war orphan. But I would not have got, I would not be able to get a college education if the same circumstances occurred. The tuition for a junior college, no way could that have been paid. It just would not have happened. And I now pay the government a lot of money in taxes because my wife is a chief executive of a very successful community foundation. We're in the top 2%, occasionally the 1% when I have a best-selling book out. So we pay a lot of taxes. We are a good example of investing in people.
Mm-hmm.
We have lots of people. I have found no difficulty here where I live in Rochester, New York, which has the second worst extreme poverty rate of mid-sized cities in America. Every sixth person in Rochester, traditionally one of the richest cities in America, every sixth person lives in extreme poverty. And I'm sorry, yeah, every sixth, 16%. Young people who can't go to community college, even if you told them it was free, there's no money for bus fare. Mm-hmm. And it's way out in the suburbs. So, we need to recognize that if we want our country to improve, we have to invest in education. We have to recognize that, poor kids are often smarter than rich kids. We want to focus on everybody getting a good education. And that doesn't mean just learning science and math, which we desperately need to improve. You also need to have liberal arts so that you are a citizen and you are educated and you have good judgment. There's a big effort underway, and Scott Walker is part of this, to turn community colleges into industrial schools. It's a terrible idea.
Right, and taking money away from our wonderful university system so that...
Right.
So among other things, well, people will be leaving, of course. Some of our best minds will be leaving, but also the tuition is just inevitably going to increase. And so even more so, only rich kids would be able to come to UW.
And my students who come from China and Korea,
yes,
many of whom are poor, they're paid, many of them, by their government to come and get a better education. That's just extraordinary. I mean, that's what we should be doing. We should be figuring out how to get the maximum amount of education because that will make us richer in the future. It'll have cost us some money today, so somebody my age, 66, is not going to benefit a lot from it, but my children, my grandchildren,